Part 1. Germany. Chapter 1. The Sled. By my fifth winter, I had mastered the skill of riding a sled on my own. With luck and good fortune, December of 1927 in Preußisch Holland was filled with snow beyond the imagination. The hill beyond the old Jewish cemetery, with its craggy imperfections, created the perfect downhill adventure. For the first time, I discovered the competing wonders of independence and daring. A reminder of my first steps, but grander and so much better. Now my world was expanded. I could roam further than my eyes would take me. Riding a sled, hurtling downhill, replaced that sense of fear. The safety of being held, with my stubborn desire to be free from protective arms. Here was something I could do alone, a risk I understood and was eager to undertake. When Father first introduced me to sledding, I was too young to tackle the hill without help. As I climbed aboard the sled and wiggled my small body against his, I felt those uneasy moments of anticipation. I remember shutting my eyes and holding on with all of my strength, my hands tightly clenched as we headed downward. I recall that thrill of riding the sled wrapped in Father's strong arms, so gentle, yet so secure. We would sit upright atop the sled. Father would be in back, I would ride in front, my small back to his large chest. As we raced down the hill, my eyes would narrow, all else would blur. Flakes of loose snow would cling to my face, frozen with little needles of ice. My nose would drip, small icicles would form, steaming hot chocolate, too hot to hold in my cold, gloveless hands would be the reward that waited to end the day. Those winter days, even my decade-old sisters would join the fun. Lotta, the middle sister, was fearless, her excitement hard to contain and contagious. She and I would fly down the hill, tumbling over and over each other when we reached the bottom. And she would laugh. No matter what, Lotta would laugh. That was the way Lotta was about everything. Lotta always knew how to laugh. Truda, the oldest, would shout the instructions. She was the one who told us what to do. She expected us to listen. Ilsa, the youngest, would ride the hill cautiously, taking care with each turn. She was prone to mishaps. With Ilsa, anything could happen. Even then, when I was 5, I could see how each differed from the other. That winter, I raced against the older and bigger kids. Everyone would jostle for position at the top. Someone would yell, "Go!" and like a wave, we would all start together and dive down the hill, each fighting against the other. It was a continuing competition to see who could reach the bottom first. We would forget the windy cold air and listen only to the sound of the snow as it brushed along the blades. This was my discovery that winter of 1927. Age provided many privileges. As long as I stayed in the company of others, I was allowed to navigate the 3 blocks to the hill without a parent or sister holding my hand. My wool mittens were replaced with leather gloves. Not that soft leather, but the thick leather with wool linings that kept hands and fingers warm. Mother knitted the perfect cap, one that covered my entire head except for the slits that opened for my eyes, ears, nose, and mouth. We all wore the same. Then we were all exactly alike, and there was nothing to keep us apart. It was a different time, and in East Prussia, children from a young age were safe to explore on their own. We would run through neighbors' yards, building snowmen and snow forts, and wage war with snowball fights. I felt special, but was one of many. My friends and I stayed under the protective guidance and watchful eyes of the older kids. All had younger brothers and sisters they tended. All parents were our parents. I was just one more in the pack of kids racing down that hill, and in that pack there was always room for one more. Snow deep and dusty white arrived early that year. On Christmas Eve, I was thrilled when Father and Mother presented me with a new sled replacing the worn and cumbersome hand-me-down my older sisters had used before me. My new sled instantly became my best friend. We shared that sleepless night, huddled in deep conversation. Now, nearly 80 years later, I still feel the excitement, anticipation, and pure joy that I felt that Christmas. Whatever my life has encountered, that night and that feeling will always remain. It can never be taken. The heights of happiness deserve to be savored, embraced, and only reluctantly forgotten. My sled was new, not repaired or worn like the old one. It was sleek, sure to be fast, and handmade just for me. Much different from the sleds I was to give my children years later. This sled had no handles to push to turn left or right. Turning required leaning all your weight in this direction or that, a maneuver those younger could not perform. There was no handbrake to stop. Stopping required a sudden, abrupt lean, almost to the point of turning the sled over, making the sled spin and reverse direction. I still feel my smile stretched across my face the first time that remarkable feat was accomplished. And I remember my hands on hips, no big deal nonchalance, when I stood up, hoping, but not wanting, to draw the attention of others. The sled's runners were wooden and the width of snow skis. The tips were turned like ram's horns, curved to a point that, no matter how deep the snow, the sled would glide endlessly. Each ride promised to be the ride of a lifetime. Best of all, the sled belonged to me. That winter, I waxed the runners and cared for that sled just like Father taught me. We all knew that waxing the runners was the secret to speed. It was a secret only known and carefully shared among our fraternity of downhill racers, passed from older to younger in hushed tones. Each year, through my childhood, that sled and I shared our winters together. As I grew older, skis would compete, both cross-country and downhill, but the sled remained my favorite. Each winter, it was my trusted companion. Even after our world had changed and so many doors were closed, that craggy hill beyond the old Jewish cemetery remained open. Wearing our ski masks and riding our sleds on a cold, wintry, snow-filled day, nothing separated us. For these moments, we were all the same. When I was 10, the sled sat on the school stage for the Christmas pageant. I narrated the story of Joseph and Mary, a ritual repeated annually by each class in front of proud parents. That year, my parents sat in the very front row. Without warning, only months following that Christmas of 1932, I was no longer welcome. I was no longer part of the pack. That pageant would be the last time I ever set foot on any school stage. New rules would be established. I would find myself on the other side of a line that had been drawn. one that I could not cross. It was a matter of race. I no longer belonged. A few years later, when my sister Trude's daughter Ruth was old enough, I shared the magical secrets of my sled with her. My young niece and her parents drove the 18 kilometers from Elbing to visit us at the farm in Crossen nearly every Sunday afternoon. Oh, how Ruth loved to be pulled on the sled through the snow, across the meadow and fields. She would sit so straight and upright, one moment serious and grinning the next. That winter, when we glided down the hill behind the old cemetery, she would throw her head back and laugh with pure joy, just like my sister Lotta would do. I still remember that day Ruth pushed my arms aside and told me that she could do this on her own. I was so proud. And she smiled in the same way I had smiled only a few years before. With my own sisters older and fully grown, Ruth became my little sister, and I became her older brother. It has always been that way. I have always believed this was good for her. I know it was good for me. Winter in 1938 was cut short when we quickly left for Berlin, leaving most of our broken possessions and our East Prussia lives behind, never to be retrieved. That day we left, before leaving for the train station, my last gift to Ruth was my prize sled. She was 5 now and skilled in its use. I hugged her and told her she was old enough to have a sled of her own. I made her whisper and promise to wax the runners just like I had done. Ruth and her parents would not leave Elbing. They stayed through the war. They felt safe and unaffected. By 1941, war had turned our worlds upside down. Their lives in danger, Ruth, her infant brother, and my sister Trude still remained in Elbing. Great Britain had declared war on Germany to stop the horror. Ruth's father, Walter, was serving as a German soldier. I had fled to Scotland and joined the British Army. Now we were enemies. My sister Ilse was in Shanghai with mother, father, Arthur, and Frank. As for my sister Lotta, the one who loved to laugh, by then we had little idea where Lotta was. By then we had lost touch with one another. We had lost the way to communicate. And the sled? It was called to serve the wars well. The children of Elbing were instructed to bring their snow sleds to the army supply depot. It was their duty. Sleds were needed to help transport supplies to the German front lines. Ruth added a tag with her name and reluctantly handed the sled over to the German soldiers. Her wintry days with Uncle Gerhard would have to remain warm memories. To her amazement, the sled was returned within days. The army had more sleds than were needed. The sled was put into the cellar for safekeeping. It would have a life when the war was over. It was bitterly cold in January of 1945 when the Russian invasion of Elbing began. That night, as the fires burned and the sky was lit bright orange, Ruth and her mother Trude retrieved the sled. They loaded young Manfred and pulled him down the street. They checked on neighbors to see who remained and who was left, and searched for any food that might have been left behind. They scavenged for kerosene, firewood, and water. My old sled still had a use. When they returned to their apartment, Ruth, Manfred, and Trude joined others moving into the cellar, the bomb shelter for the 10 families who remained nearby. They hoped to survive the overhead battle between their German protectors and the invading Red Army. 3 weeks later, after the Germans had been defeated, the victorious Russians went block to block, searching and freeing civilians who had survived the intense bombing. The cellar doors were thrown open. Ruth, her mother, and her brother emerged into the daylight to learn their fate. They had no knowledge of the destruction that had taken place above their heads. They only knew that they had heard the thundering sounds of bombs and felt the ground shudder. No one could imagine the horrors that would await them. The sled would never be seen again. A generation later. I too learned to ride a sled in my father's arms. This was in the early 1950s, on the hill behind the cemetery at Sinisippi Park in Rockford. My red flexible flyer was much different from the sled Dad had used in East Prussia in 1927. I'm sure the hill was different too, but I bet the feeling was the same. The way the snow felt against my face, the comfort of his big arms wrapped around me, even the drips from my nose forming icicles. I, too, remember the thrill, the pure joy, the pure elation, and the anticipation the first time we set off from the top of the hill. I learned the story of Dad's sled shortly after I became a grandparent, and Dad a great-grandparent. I guess he was feeling sentimental, sharing the story as we walked together along the beach that day. Before, I never thought to ask where or when he learned to sled. Like so many other questions, it never was that important. Just another I never thought to ask. I suppose that is true about many things parents teach their children. We take for granted most things taught. We seldom ask questions before the answers are known. There was much about Dad that I knew little about. Not bad stuff, not great stuff, nothing astonishing, nothing to be hidden. No, the fabric that makes stories, the little details of his life, his history, the family facts, and mostly his emotions. Dad tended to keep his emotions private. I suppose most parents try to shield their emotions from their children. I know we did, and still do. Now I find it hard to remember. Did I ever see him cry? Did I ever know his anguish? Dad was a quiet, respectful, and unpretentious man. Only when he was older did he speak much. By then I was away raising my own family, and as Ginger will attest, I am seldom a very good listener. I remember, too, the first time he gave a push, let go, and watched nervously as I traversed the hill on my own. I remember when I did the same for my son, and I'm certain he did it for his children. Dad always encouraged me to go forward with my life, to stand on my own feet, to be comfortable in my own skin, to take measure of my own risks. He never held me back. He wanted me to be confident that I could care for myself. I always knew that he believed I would succeed. This was the way he was raised. It was the way I was raised. I hope we raised Zach that way too. My dad, or Jerry as his friends and co-workers would call him, was more than anything else, a good guy. I never met anyone who thought otherwise. He was curious, resourceful, sometimes strangely opinionated, wicked smart in a non-book kind of way, a devoted parent, a loving husband, never a pain in the ass. I can't say he was humble, but he certainly was modest. I never thought of him as stingy, but he was careful and frugal. He had his own sense of humor. Unlike Mom, he could never remember a joke, particularly the punchline. He loved to flirt. He mixed strange drinks. Steady would be a way to describe him. I don't think of him as moody. Perhaps Mom did at times. Sometimes he loved to disagree, to pretend to know better. I never disliked him. Can't remember ever having an argument with him. He never struck me or any family member, and I never struck him. I cannot say a bad word about him. He was a good provider. He was honest. He was polite. He listened more than he spoke. He had a sense of adventure, but was cautious with risk. With Dad, it was never his way or the highway. He had his opinions and never relinquished his right to be right. But I seldom remember a time when he imposed. He might state his case, but mostly deferred when I stated mine. That was true whether the discussion was bedtime, report cards, or using his car. Topics like religion or politics were generally left for Mom. Dad was never one to debate those unsolvable matters. Even as a child, I was always afforded his respect. The only absolute I can ever remember was this one simple rule. Whatever it was, if it was German-made or German-sold, he would not buy it. I always loved my dad, and I knew him better as I grew older. With time, he became my very best friend. Now, perfect cannot be described and is impossible to claim. But close to perfect is the mental picture I ask you to have, not only of Dad, but the rest of my family, my wife, my mother, my sister, my son, his wife, my grandchildren. I would never suggest that we are the best or better than most, nor do I wish to compare to anyone else. I'm just offering that, as far as families go, we are pretty typical, pretty happy, and generally satisfied with life. Normal would be the best description. At least that's my view most of the time. I know you will ask. No, I'm not trying to set you up in the first act for a nasty surprise in the second. I'm just trying to describe who we are. No parent is perfect, nor are their children. That pretty much sums it up. That's all I need to say.